This is Hannah Tierney reading my and Daniel Tellock's article, The Comparative Non-Arbitrariness Norm of Blame, originally published in the Open Access Journal of Ethics and Social Philosophy. For purposes of this recording, footnotes are omitted. Blame is governed by a range of norms. Most centrally, blame is subject to a norm of correctness or fittingness. Understood as a retrospective response that represents its targets as being blameworthy for, typically, an action, blame can be appropriate only if it correctly represents the blamee. Blame's fittingness thus requires that the blamee in fact be blameworthy, and that the blame be proportionate to his blameworthiness. The blamer must also be justified in believing that the blamee is blameworthy, otherwise the epistemic norm of blame is flouted. And even if the target of blame is blameworthy, and the blamer is justified in believing them to be so, blame may still be inappropriate in virtue of violating a norm governing the moral standing to blame. For example, if an agent blames another for a wrong that they themselves have performed and have refused to acknowledge and apologize for, or if they were instrumental in the blamee's doing that for which he is blameworthy, then the agent may lack the standing to blame. A great deal has been written about these aforementioned norms, and each plays an important role in accounting for the ethics of blame. In this paper, we argue that there exists another norm of blame that is yet to receive adequate philosophical discussion, and without which an account of the ethics of blame will be incomplete, a norm prescribing comparatively arbitrary blame. Even when blame is fitting, is epistemically justified, and the blamer has the standing to blame, blame may be inappropriate in virtue of being comparatively arbitrary. That is, even when the above norms of blame are satisfied, there remains something morally objectionable about a state of affairs in which an agent blames two individuals to significantly different degrees for actions that do not ultimately differ in normative significance. The relative absence of a comparative non-arbitrariness norm in the moral responsibility literature is somewhat surprising, given that criminal law theorists have paid a good deal of attention to parallel questions about the criteria for and limits to comparatively non-arbitrary criminal sanctioning. Whatever the reason for this inconspicuousness, by making explicit and defining our commitment to a norm against comparatively arbitrary blame, we stand to acquire a richer understanding of the ethics of blame and of the norms of moral responsibility more broadly. We proceed as follows. In section 1, we present a comparative non-arbitrariness condition on blame, or the comparative condition, CC for short. In section 2, we address two objections that threaten CC's explanatory power: the objection from fittingness and the objection from forward-looking considerations. In section 3, we consider whether CC can be applied interpersonally and argue that CC is best conceived of as a purely intrapersonal norm. Finally, in section 4, we bring things to a non-arbitrary conclusion by reflecting on the work CC can do by being added to an ethics of blame. Section 1, the comparative condition. Imagine that a parent's two adult children conspire to steal $10,000 from her bank account. The parent blames both children, but to significantly differing degrees. She gives one child a stern talking to and demands that they repay her $5,000, but gives the other child only a stern talking to. We stipulate that both the adult children stole their parents' money freely and are blameworthy for doing so. Additionally, the parent justifiably believes that both children engage in this blameworthy behavior. We can also assume that the parent successfully meets all standing conditions to blame. Thus, in this case, all extant fittingness, epistemic, and standing conditions for blame are met. But there is something deeply inappropriate about the parent's response to her children. When blame is at issue, like cases must be treated alike. If the parent blames one child by demanding partial repayment, then, ceteris paribus, she should blame the other child to the same extent. Of course, it is possible that these are not like cases. There could be relevant differences between the children that justify the parent's pattern of blaming behavior. Perhaps one of the children was pressured into stealing the money by the other child, and for this reason is less blameworthy. Or perhaps the parent abandoned one of the children at birth, such that she does not have the appropriate relationship to blame them in the same way she blames her other child. But if the two children are guilty of the same offense to the same degree, and the parent relates to both children and their wrongdoings in the same way, then it would be morally objectionable to blame them to substantially different degrees. To do so, as the parent in our example does, is to blame in a way that is comparatively arbitrary and thus pro tanto inappropriate. To capture the intuition that comparatively arbitrary blame is inappropriate, we propose that our responsibility practices display sensitivity to the comparative non-arbitrariness condition of blame, or the comparative condition, CC. CC. If A blames B for some action X to a sufficiently greater or lesser degree than A blames C for X, and there is no morally relevant difference between either 1. B or C's relationship to X, or 2. A's moral or epistemic standing relative to B or C, then A's blame of B and C is inappropriate in virtue of being comparatively arbitrary. Each of the two kinds of morally relevant differences, 1 and 2, is capable of justifying a significant differential in blame. B's relationship to the action X may differ from C's relationship to X in a morally relevant way. If B's performance of X requires a substantially greater degree of effort, say, or is expressive of a poorer quality of will. In this case, B may be the fitting target of a greater degree of blame than C, and so A's blame differential will not be normatively arbitrary. Similarly, if A is complicit in B's but not C's wrongdoing, then A might lack or have diminished moral standing to blame B. In this case, because there is a normatively relevant difference in A's moral standing relative to B and C, the blame differential might be justified. Finally, if A's epistemic situation relevantly differs with respect to B's and C's wrongdoing, perhaps A has decisive evidence that B acted culpably while possessing only weak evidence regarding C's culpability, then a differential in A's blame will not be comparatively arbitrary. In short, CC is violated when the differential in blame is explained neither by B's and C's relation to the action, nor by A's moral or epistemic standing to blame B and C. In virtue of what, however, is CC violating blame objectionable? One might suppose that it is objectionable in virtue of violating a general norm against the arbitrary treatment of persons, one requiring that we treat morally like individuals alike. If this is the case, one could explain why arbitrary blame is morally objectionable without reference to a blame-specific norm like CC. This proposal, however, is without promise. In many areas of our life, it is permissible to treat relevantly similar individuals dissimilarly. We can confide in, become friends with, fall in love with, and marry one individual without treating relevantly similar individuals in the same way. Now, one might rightly be disappointed when one learns that an individual who shares all their relevant features has been confided in, befriended, fallen in love with, or married to someone who has not treated them in a similar way. But though perhaps disappointing, there need not be anything morally objectionable about such treatment. Agents, even morally good agents, and even those no worse than those dear to us, do not, as such, have a claim or right to our confidences, friendship, love, or hand in marriage. For this reason, these and other related practices and patterns of concern permissibly admit of significant degrees of arbitrariness. But this is not so for blame. Blame is governed by a set of norms different from those applicable to the above-mentioned forms of treatment. Why should blame be special in this way? This is possibly because we have a right or claim on others to not be harmed without reason, and blame characteristically imposes a not insignificant amount of harm on its targets. An idea common to many views of blame is that blame characteristically adversely affects the interests of or harms the blamee. Even if blame does not necessarily harm the blamed, e.g., if the blame remains unexpressed or if the blamee is indifferent to others' evaluations and actions, there is a more than accidental connection between blame and harm. Blame is characteristically manifested in negative modes of expression and treatment, like avoidance, reproach, scolding, denunciation, remonstration, and, at the limit, punishment. It is in virtue of this connection between blame and harm that responsibility theorists sometimes claim that blame responses involve liability to sanctions, or at least sanction-like responses. In our central case, the burdensome or sanction-like nature of blame is evident, as the demand to repay $5,000 and being the target of a condemnatory lecture both typically adversely affect one's interests. In light of blame's sanction-like nature, together with our right or claim not to be harmed without sufficient reason, blame can be unfair. Indeed, blame can be unfair in a variety of ways. Theorists of responsibility have focused on the ways that blame might be non-comparatively unfair, as blame would arguably be if it turned out that we were the sorts of agents who lacked the kind of free will or control over our actions necessary to be morally responsible. If we were the sorts of agents who lacked the requisite capacities, whatever they are, to be the fitting objects of blame, then even if everyone was blamed to the same degree for the same kinds of actions, that blame might nonetheless be unfair in a non-comparative sense. The same can be said for blame that violates the epistemic and standing conditions that govern our blaming practices. But CC violating blame is unfair in a different way. It is comparatively unfair, as it relies on a significant differential in blame directed towards multiple agents who are relevantly similar. In our central case, the parent meets both the standing and epistemic conditions on blame, and each child is blamed to a fitting degree, So there is nothing non-comparatively unfair about the parent's blame. But the parent's blame of her children is nonetheless comparatively unfair. For, in blaming one child with a stern talking to, plus the demand of repayment, and the other with only a stern talking to, the blamer burdens the former to a significantly greater degree, in effect giving less weight to one of the children's claims not to be harmed without sufficient reason. As such, the more severely blamed child is treated comparatively unfairly. We contend that it is in virtue of being comparatively unfair in this way that CC violating blame is pro tanto morally wrong. To conclude this section, we highlight two aspects of CC that might not be immediately transparent. First, CC targets cases in which A's blame of B and C differs to a sufficiently great degree. It may be that some differentials in blame are too minuscule to make a normative difference. Or, perhaps even the smallest differential of blame is sufficiently great. We take no stance on this issue. Second, in saying that A's blame of B and C is inappropriate, we secure CC's status as an essentially comparative norm. That is, if A arbitrarily blames B to a sufficiently different degree than she blames C, the inappropriateness of A's blame does not reside simply in the degree to which A blames B or the degree to which A blames C. This is because it is possible that, when considered non-comparatively, A's blame of B is appropriate and A's blame of C is appropriate. If so, the inappropriateness of A's blame of B and C can only be understood comparatively. We explore this thought below in replying to the objection from fittingness. Section 2, the emptiness objection. In this section, we address two objections that, if sound, would render CC explanatorily epiphenomenal: the objection from fittingness and the objection from forward-looking considerations. According to the former, fittingness can do all the normative work to explain why comparatively arbitrary blame is morally objectionable, while the latter contends that forward-looking considerations alone can account for its objectionableness. Section 2.1, the objection from fittingness. One might argue that CC does not do any independent normative or explanatory work. After all, morally like cases share morally relevant intrinsic features, and so perhaps the fittingness conditions that supervene on these features will, all by themselves, guarantee that like cases should be treated alike. If so, fittingness norms alone can explain what is wrong with a comparatively arbitrary blame. But if norms of fittingness do all the normative work, then even if CC issues the right verdicts, it will be normatively and explanatorily epiphenomenal. To develop this objection, let us return to the case of the adult children embezzling $10,000 from their parent. Recall that the parent blames one child by giving them a stern talking to and demanding that they repay her $5,000, and blames the other child by only giving them a stern talking to. Given that the blamer has qualitatively identical, or identical in every morally relevant respect, relations to each of the children, and is equally justified in believing that each child is equally culpable, there is something deeply inappropriate about one child getting a stern talking to and the other child getting a stern talking to and the demand to make a $5,000 repayment for performing the same blameworthy act. One might, however, doubt that we need CC to tell us why this is so. The proponent of the objection from fittingness can propose an alternative explanation. The same degree of blame is fitting for both embezzlers, and the norm of fittingness provides a sufficient normative basis for the claim that one of the embezzlers is blamed objectionably. We can stipulate that both agents, Agent 1 and 2, are motivated to the same degree by the same morally dubious reasons to steal their parents' money, and that the contents and strengths of all the attitudes relevant to their equally bad actions are qualitatively identical. Suppose 5-5 designates the type of action that each perform, and that an agent who performs 5-5 is the fitting object of blame to degree DN. Since Agent 1 and Agent 2 each performs action 5-5, they are each fitting objects of blame to degree DN. Now, it will indeed be inappropriate if Agent 1 receives blame to degree DN, while Agent 2 receives blame to degree DN-1, but, the objector continues, this is explained not by some independent norm regarding comparative non-arbitrariness, but simply by the fact that Agent 2 receives less blame than is fitting. So, even if CC issues the right verdict regarding Agent 1 and Agent 2, if all the normative work is done by the internal features of the case and the respective fittingness conditions, reference to CC will be normatively odious. The problem with the above explanation, we contend, is its presupposition that for any given blameworthy action, there is a unique degree of blame that is fitting. This presupposition is neither widely shared in the responsibility literature, nor is it independently plausible. CC earns its keep partly because the fittingness conditions of blame generally license a spectrum of appropriate responses. The spectrum thesis has been implicit in the above discussion, and it will be worthwhile to provide some motivation for it. The falsity of the spectrum thesis, i.e. the truth of the uniqueness thesis, would require that for each blameworthy action type, there is a single unique degree of blame that is fitting as a response. If there were a unique degree of blame that were alone fitting for any given blameworthy type of action, then the margin of fitting blame would be extremely narrow. But intuitively, there are a variety of ways to appropriately blame someone who is blameworthy. In response to the same slight, one person might angrily confront the slighter, another may temporarily distance himself from the slighter, and yet another might privately resent the slighter. Should we think that, just because they differ in degree, two or perhaps all of these responses are unfitting? The uniqueness theorist is committed to this exceedingly strong claim. While there will surely be an upper threshold past which one's blame it will be excessive, and a lower threshold beneath which one's blame might be objectionably lenient, there is intuitively a bounded range of fitting responses for any given blameworthy action. The spectrum thesis is intuitively true of many responses beyond blame. Our responses of gratitude, regret, disappointment, trust, pride, admiration, fear, amusement, hope, and frustration, among many others, are valuable for fittingness. And when any such response would be fitting, there will normally be several qualitatively distinct ways of fittingly reacting with a response of that type. To illustrate, consider the implausibility of a uniqueness thesis as applied to fitting responses of comic amusement. If there were a uniquely fitting degree of comic amusement for any particular joke, then given the wildly varying degrees of laughter in comedy clubs and movie theaters, most and perhaps all responses to jokes would be unfitting. But surely the norms surrounding humor permit a wide range of fitting responses to things that are funny. It would be jarring to witness a large group of individuals responding with exactly the same degree of amusement to a joke or humorous story. We take it that the same would be said of a group of individuals who blamed a blameworthy agent to exactly the same degree. The point here does not depend on the assumption that blame functions just like amusement or other fitting reactions. We are likely to be more permissive about the range of fitting responses to jokes than we are about the range of fitting responses to moral wrongs. Nevertheless, it would be surprising if instead of simply displaying a more restricted range of fitting responses, it turned out that blame did not actually warrant ranges of fitting responses at all. Let us return to the embezzling adult children case. What is wrong with this case is not that one agent received too little blame or that the other agent received too much. One, stern talking to's, and two, stern talking to's in addition to demands for partial repayment are both appropriate ways of blaming such acts of embezzlement. It would be appropriate if the parent gave both children stern talking to's and demanded that each child pay her $5,000, or only gave both children stern talking to's, for example. It is only by invoking a relational or comparative norm like CC that we can identify what is inappropriate about the parents blaming one of their children in manner one and the other in manner two. Although both instances of blame are fitting, there is more to appropriate blame than fittingness, and epistemic justification and standing. Given that there is no relevant difference in the parent's beliefs about each child's culpability, her relationships to the two children, or between the children's relationships to the blame or the actions they perform, if one child receives one and the other two, we have reason to conclude that the disparity in strength of blame is inappropriate in virtue of being comparatively arbitrary. Thus, norms of fittingness do not render CC normatively odiose. Section 2.2, the objection from forward-looking considerations. Even if fittingness cannot, all by itself, provide an explanation for the objectionableness of comparatively arbitrary blame, perhaps other explanations are available. In particular, one might think that a forward-looking explanation can provide a suitable alternative to CC. Our opponent might maintain that our blaming responses are subject to a backward-looking norm of fittingness, but that there are also forward-looking reasons for blame to appear fitting, both to the blamees and to observers. For if our blame responses appear arbitrary, as they sometimes will when two agents are blamed to different but fitting degrees, blame may lose some of its deterrent or rehabilitative efficacy. Perhaps if blamees and the moral community generally had all the relevant information and so understood that seemingly comparatively arbitrary instances of blame were really different but fitting instances of blame, then there would be no problem with blame in different but fitting ways. But observers and recipients of our blaming responses typically do not have all the relevant information and often will not understand that seemingly arbitrary instances of blame are only seemingly arbitrary. To avoid appearances of arbitrariness, then, we should blame wrongdoers to the same fitting degree. In response, We grant that there may be forward-looking reasons for our blaming responses not to appear arbitrary, but it is not plausible that forward-looking considerations are the only or even the primary reasons to not blame wrongdoers to different degrees. For, even in cases where the blamees will acknowledge that each of the blame responses is fitting, we contend that they will still find it morally objectionable that one is blamed more severely, and so has his interests more adversely affected, than the other. The following strikes us as a reasonable response that the more severely blamed person may issue. Yes, but why should I be blamed more severely? This sort of reaction will be available to them even if they realize that both instances of blame are fitting. A parent might believe that each of the following is a fitting response to a child's breaking curfew. 1, grounding the child for a night, and 2, verbally communicating disapproval and giving the child a second chance. But thinking back on some occasion when, as a teenager, he, i.e. the parent, was grounded while his sibling was merely scolded for breaking curfew, he may continue to believe that there was something objectionable, indeed unfair, and is being blamed more severely than his sibling. The forward-looking reasons for blame to appear non-arbitrary are likely derivative of the backward-looking reasons against comparatively arbitrary blame. To illustrate, consider a similar forward-looking explanation of the wrongness of hypocritical blame. One might hold that if the blamee is indeed a fitting target of blame, hypocritical blame, i.e. blame issued by a blamer who is unapologetically guilty of the same offense for which he blames another, is not objectionable in itself. But as the blamee is likely to be defensive when he is blamed by another who unapologetically commits the same wrong, such blame is unlikely to be effective and may even be counterproductive. Although it is true that this sort of blame is unlikely to be effective, this is intuitively because it is morally objectionable in itself. In replying, "Who are you to blame me?" the blamee is not merely deflecting blame, but voicing a reasonable objection about the prerequisites for having the standing to blame. So while there is plausibly a forward-looking reason not to blame hypocritically, this reason is parasitic on the backward-looking reason that hypocritical blame is objectionable in itself. Likewise, comparatively arbitrary blame is less likely to be effective at promoting rehabilitation and deterrence, but we contend that this is chiefly because comparatively arbitrary blame is unfair in itself. In our view, the forward-looking reasons to not blame in comparatively arbitrary ways are thus parasitic on the backward-looking reason against arbitrary blame. Section 3. Why is CC an intrapersonal but not interpersonal norm? We have presented CC as an intrapersonal norm that governs an agent's blame of other equally blameworthy agents. But one might wonder whether CC can be applied interpersonally as well. That is, can CC constrain how distinct blamers blame individuals who have committed similar wrongs? Imagine that two different unrelated parents, P1 and P2, discover that each of their adult children, C1 and C2, has embezzled $10,000 from each of them. We can imagine that all the relevant facts about these two cases are the same. The adult children are equally blameworthy for stealing the money, the parents justifiably believe to the same degree that their respective children embezzled from them, and the parents relate to their children in qualitatively identical ways. If P1 blames C1 by giving them a stern talking to and demanding a $5,000 repayment, and P2 blames C2 by only giving them a stern talking to, has something inappropriate occurred? Since we think that there exists a spectrum of fitting responses to a given blameworthy action, and C1 and C2 have performed qualitatively identical blameworthy actions, we think it is perfectly appropriate for P1 to blame C1 by giving them a stern talking to and demanding partial repayment, and for P2 to blame C2 by only giving them a stern talking to. After all, there is nothing morally suspect about one parent choosing to ground their child for breaking curfew and another parent choosing to simply verbally communicate their disapproval for doing the same. However, there is something inappropriate, and deeply so if you ask the children involved, about a parent choosing to ground one of their children for breaking curfew, but not their other child for doing the same. In such a case, the parent gives one child's moral claim to not being harmed for that reason greater weight than she gives the others. Her blame is therefore comparatively unfair. We have an obligation to be consistent in our blame of others, but we do not have an obligation to render our blame in line with how others blame. Moreover, on the assumption that the spectrum thesis is true, we cannot have an obligation to blame in a way that is consistent with others, since the relevant others might themselves blame to different but fitting degrees. While it is possible for me to blame to the same degree that A does, I cannot blame to the same degree that both A and B do, if A and B blame to different but fitting degrees. Now, one could argue that though we are now not required to render our blame in line with others' blame, we should hold ourselves to the same standards we think others ought to be held to. For example, imagine that P1, prior to blaming C1, learns that P2 blames C2 by only giving them a stern talking to. Imagine further that P1 judges P2's blame to be appropriate and thinks there is no relevant differences between their two situations. One might argue that P1 should then blame C1 to the same degree that P2 blames C2. Perhaps non-arbitrariness norms like CC should not require agents to be consistent with how others blame, but they should require that blamers be consistent with their judgments about how others blame. If this is correct, then one could modify CC to capture these kinds of cases, and it could still remain an entirely intrapersonal norm. However, we would resist such revisions to CC. We contend that it is perfectly consistent for P1 to judge that P2 blames C2 appropriately and to judge that her own blame of C1 is also appropriate despite differing in degree. Just as we think there exists a spectrum of appropriate responses to blameworthy agents, we also think agents can coherently judge that distinct instances of blame are appropriate, even if they differ in degree. Of course, reflecting on what you take to be appropriate instances of blame could lead you to revise your judgments about other instances of blame and even your own blaming practices. If, upon reflection, P1 judges that it is appropriate for P2 to blame C2 by only giving them a stern talking to, P1 might question whether their decision to demand partial repayment from C1 was really appropriate. But revisiting one's judgments about the appropriateness of an act of blame in light of how others blame is not an expression of a commitment to non-arbitrariness. Rather, it is most likely an expression of epistemic humility. These are important but distinct norms that we should be careful not to conflate. While the way others blame is not irrelevant to how we ourselves ought to blame, we do not have an obligation to render our blame in line with others' blame, even if we deem it appropriate. We do, however, have an obligation to be consistent in our own blaming responses. Thus, we think CC is properly conceived of as a purely intrapersonal norm. Section 4, Conclusion. In this paper, we first developed a norm prescribing comparatively arbitrary blame, CC. Next, we defended CC against two charges of explanatory vacuity, and then argued that it properly applies only to instances of interpersonally arbitrary blame. We will now conclude by briefly reflecting on the importance of including CC in an ethics of blame. Given the inherently social character of moral responsibility, its arena regularly referred to as that of the community of morally responsible agents, it is unsurprising that we care not only about the way in which others blame us, but also about the way others blame us relative to their blame of similar agents. Given the literature's focus on non-comparative norms of blame, it is difficult to give voice to what is wrong with blaming relevantly similar agents to different degrees. After all, it would not be right to say that such blame is unfitting or that the blamer lacks moral or epistemic standing. CC, however, can identify what is morally objectionable about the blame in such cases. It is comparatively arbitrary, and so treats one of the blamees comparatively unfairly. As theorists of blame and responsibility are already committed to understanding the conditions under which blame is fair, they should not exclude the conditions under which blame may be comparatively unfair, especially given the inherently social character of moral responsibility. In acknowledging the moral relevance of an individual's blame of multiple agents, CC sheds new light both on the nature of blame and the ways in which blame can be morally objectionable. Once we are able to properly diagnose what is wrong with these blaming interactions, we are in a position to improve them. By focusing on the comparative aspects of blame, CC is poised to contribute to both our understanding and the improvement of the practices of blame.